looks for a shot in!
Arsenal will always be in my blood and in my heart.
It's Thierry Henry! He scored! He scored for Arsenal in the Bernabeu! No more, no less than they...
This is another Arsenal in My Blood podcast with your host, AJ Matuchniak, and as always, I'm with my friend who is now not across the pond as I am back in America. But yeah, my good friend Ryan, how are you doing today?
AJ, good to be back on the pod. I'm doing just fine. I'm doing a lot better than I think a lot of Arsenal supporters are the day after the closing of the transfer window. So I'm optimistic. I'm feeling good. You know, came off a win against Newcastle, so we got an international break. Always good to go into an international break with 3 points off the back, as opposed to losing or dropping points. So all in all, I'm good, man. I'm good. You're back in the States. Welcome back.
Thank you. You
were at Newcastle away. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
So that's awesome, because personally, one of my kind of bucket list sporting event experiences I want to do is have an Arsenal away day. I've been to the Emirates. It's an amazing experience, but I think there's just something special that I noticed while watching matches on TV about being at a visitor's ground with the Arsenal fans in the away section. There's a special kind of energy, atmosphere, camaraderie. So Could you kind of break down the entire day? I really want to know, again, especially from an American experience, what goes into an Arsenal away day? And obviously going all the way up north to Newcastle, that's a much longer journey, than going across town to Crystal Palace like you did. So talk about the experience, the journey, the match itself, the atmosphere, just everything about an Arsenal away day.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a 12:45 kickoff, and, you know, usually when I'm here in California, and I'm sure you obviously have to have it in Arizona as well, I usually have to wake up at around 4 for, like, the 4:45.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's 4:45 in the morning here and 5:45 for you or whatever it is. For the Newcastle game, it's practically the same. I had to wake up around 3 a.m., got up, and unfortunately for my uncle, had to wake him up and tell him to drive me to the Arsenal stadium, because they actually set up a coach, through Arsenal, that they set up a coach that you can take from the Arsenal stadium and a few other various points, but the closest one to me was the Arsenal stadium. So yeah, we drove up there, got there around 4:20, had to wait for freaking 40 minutes because other people came late to show up to the bus. But anyway, got on the bus 5 o'clock. And literally made it to the stadium at around 12:20, 12:30. So we got it pretty tight. Yeah, it was a good 7-hour journey. Yeah, it was kind of strange though, because the bus, I mean, as much as it really didn't have that much leg room or anything, as you can imagine, it was actually quite like an airplane. Like, I brought a lot of food because I knew I was going to be going there and back. But I was nervous that I wasn't going to be able to leave my food in the bus, because sometimes they're picky about that kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. No, like there was like an overhead compartment, just kind of like an airplane. There was, you know, a guy coming down with like a little trolley in front of him, asking us if we wanted coffee or tea. So yeah, it was actually not too bad.
So it's like an upgraded, classier version of a Greyhound bus here in the States. That'd be a good way to describe it.
Pretty much the best way that you can describe it. But okay. I mean, there was still barely any leg room, but. I got in a little bit of sleep here and there. I was listening to a few podcasts and, you know, fall asleep in a couple of them, but that's not good for those podcasts I was listening to. No, it was going there wasn't too bad. I can tell you that, you know, really wasn't as bad as I thought. On the trip back though, even though we'd won and, you know, I was happy, but God, the trip back was a good 8 hours and I was just... Oh, because I couldn't fall asleep because it was the middle of the day at that point. So it was a rough one. And it was a really weird experience because, you know, my dad would always talk about when he was a kid, sometimes if the game wasn't on TV, he would have to listen to the radio. So we actually listened to the radio talk about, you know, Chelsea losing and Liverpool going 3-0 down and Stoke getting two red cards. It was a great weekend.
It was a great weekend for the Arsenal all around. Now, so you get up to Newcastle. You're around St. James's Park. Now, what's the atmosphere there? Are you in your Arsenal colors? Do you know anybody there? Have you made any acquaintances? Are you going solo? Talk about going into the stadium and what you're seeing, what you're experiencing.
I technically went, you know, by myself, just on the coach, but you know, you kind of end up talking to the Arsenal fans around you. At first, you know, everybody's just kind of quiet and well, I guess it was 4 a.m. so probably everybody's just really tired, but
right.
You know, you know, once we got close to the stadium, we would all kind of turn and look at each other and be like, fuck's sake, we should have signed a striker. No, but we would all look around and start talking about tactics. And it was funny because there's, you know, there's always two sides to the spectrum. There's always one guy who's saying we should have bought Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi, and the other guy's saying that, you know, we'll win the Champions League 4 years in a row with the team that we have. So, you know, it was really cool. But, yeah, two guys I talked to especially on the road up there, one guy behind me and one guy to the right of me. And, no, it was really good. We got to really discuss, you know, seriously though, what we thought about Arsenal's season so far and where we think we were going to go. And obviously the transfer window hadn't closed at that point, so discussing a lot of different things. But, you know, unfortunately we weren't actually able to sit next to each other because, you know, we all had different spots in the ground. But, you know, once I got actually to the ground, you kind of go through your own separate turnstile. You know, it's just for away support, because if you mix it with the home support, you know, there's going to be fights. So
sure,
yeah, we got inside, but you know, inside right before the game, like I said, I arrived at around 12:20, so I didn't have too much time. But that's actually a really, really fun part that I noticed also last year when I went to Leicester. So before you're inside the stadium, but you're not inside like where the seats are. So this is just like where you can buy beer or food or anything.
The concourse, you know, area.
Exactly. And people were just jumping up and screaming and chanting Arsenal songs. And you know, that's an incredibly fun part. You know, and you know, we're singing about Laurent Koscielny and people are just chucking their beers in the air. And that's something that I kind of wish the Emirates had a little more of. You know, you're not allowed to bring beer past a certain point, actually, in the Emirates, not even inside the actual stadium. So,
right.
But it was fun though. I had a really good time. Finally, then I you know, around 12:35, 12:40, walked into the actual stadium where my seats were, and it's really strange. I know you can probably tell on the camera that they have for the games, but the Newcastle stadium is incredibly weird. There's two sides where it's quite low to the ground, the seats, but then the other two sides are incredibly high, like probably even higher than the Emirates, in fact, because they still hold about 50,000 people in their ground. But yeah, it was kind of strange because they kind of just shunt the away support way up top. So I was quite far from the action, but you could see kind of the view of Newcastle though, and they have actually kind of a beautiful countryside, surprisingly. So yeah, it was still a really good experience.
Awesome. Well, so that's the journey up to the park. And of course you're in there, you're seeing it live. We'll get into kind of a match breakdown now. Early in the first half, I mean, they, you know, obviously Newcastle's plan was to come out and kick the shit out of Arsenal. I mean, that was clear from the start. I think it was Sissoko had a late stamp on Nacho that kind of set the tempo. A few niggly fouls, you know, really wanted to break up our rhythm. There was a penalty incident, which should have been it was a clear penalty, and I think it was coming at the away section, so you probably could have got a good kind of almost a bird's eye view of it. What did you guys think the away support when Bellerin was put through and Tovan just clearly just stepped on the back of his ankle? Or did you guys see it as it happened live as a clear penalty?
You know, surprisingly enough, there are certain things that you can catch in the stadium. Like, I always find that people in the stadium can see handballs a lot better than, you know, when you're watching it on TV. But I have to admit, you know, two incidences in the game. One, I'm sure we'll get to later. But yeah, that Bellerin one, it just looked like he fell over, to be honest. It looked like he lost his footing. And obviously now I've watched the replays and seen that he really kind of stamps on his ankle a little bit. So, yeah, it should have been a penalty. But, yeah, surprisingly, even though Bellerin was on our side and was running towards us, because, like I said, we're quite high up in the stadium, it kind of looked like he just slipped and fell over.
Interesting. Yeah, it was the referee's decisions. I think he did a very good job. You know, usually you can hear Arsenal away fans just about every ground. I know you guys are high up. But really hard to hear, especially that match, because the home fans were doing nothing but moaning and bitching and crying every time the ref blew his whistle, which happened to be for correct foul decisions against Newcastle. Ironically, the one decision I thought he got blatantly wrong was the non-penalty call on Bellerin. So, you know, I thought before the red card, we were dominating the match. We had a good rhythm to our passing, to our movement. I actually thought the red card did Arsenal a disservice because Newcastle at home, even though they're not going to have the majority of possession against us, they can't go all out, park the bus with 11 men because, you know, you're at home. You have to, you know, you have to give the paying fans something to cheer about. So I thought when the red card happened, Mitrovic was and he is that type of player, by the way. You know, people say, oh, it wasn't malicious or he didn't. No, if you've watched him and people that follow Serbian football or Belgian football where he came from, they'll tell you that he's exactly that type of player. So
What's up with number 45s and being just idiots?
Yeah, 45 hothead strikers. I don't know. There must be something there. But so, you know, once they went down to 10 men, they were obviously always going to go, you know, park the bus, put all 10 men behind the ball. And I think it really disrupted our rhythm. And it's, you know, any time you have to play with 10 men behind the ball, it's going to be hard to break down. It's going to be hard to create clear cut chances, which is, you know, which was the case for us on Saturday. So going into, we can talk about individual performances now. So we talked about last week on the pod that we would like to see some tactical changes, some people come into the side, some people go to the bench, and that's what we saw. We saw Giroud come out for Theo. We also saw Chamberlain come in for technically Mesut Ozil, who was out with a knee injury. So we had Ramsey drop into the 10, the attacking midfield position. Chamberlain out wide right, Theo through the middle, Alexis on the left, and Santi and Coquelin in their usual deep line midfield positions. So just overall, what did you think of the performances from really Theo and Chamberlain as they were brought into the side? What did you make of their impact on the game?
I found it quite frustrating. You know, I have to be honest because I've been crying out on the pod for the past couple episodes for Wolcott to either start on the right or up front, and especially the Ox also to start on the right. And, you know, I said that my ideal front three would be Alexis, Wolcott, and Oxlade because of just the pace that they provide. And obviously, because of the red card, you know, they did just park the bus with 10 men behind the ball. So obviously, that did make it difficult for Wolcott, who does usually need more space to run into to be effective. But I have to admit, you know, there's a lot of times where I just wouldn't focus on the ball and I would just watch Theo Wolcott, and he's just standing around. And it's not standing around where he's in between the two defenders and then he'll make a darting run and hope to lose one of them. It's not that at all. You know, it just seemed like he was standing right next to the center backs, you know, either Coloccini or Mbemba, and not really providing that much movement, which is disappointing because, I mean, come on, Wolcott, you just signed a new contract with us. You know, Wenger's giving you the opportunity to play ahead of Giroud, who I think we all know he does prefer Giroud. And I was very disappointed that Wolcott didn't step up and you know, had two clear-cut chances that he should have easily put away.
Yeah, and I think that's always been my criticism of Theo playing as a lone striker, is that he just simply – he can't do enough without the ball to merit playing that position. I mean, he physically can't back into a defender and be a spear point in the attack. He can't hold the ball up. He's not going to be an outlet in the air to bring others in as well. And but again, the reason you want him in the side is because, listen, I mean, he had the two best chances in the match. He didn't convert any of them. The second was an absolute horror miss, in my opinion. I mean, that has to be finished at that level. The first one didn't get great contact, but he was put through. Was 1v1 in the end, and he didn't finish against Kroll. But that's why I just don't think he can play in that position, especially against a compact, very tight, nine man inside the 18-yard box defense that Newcastle had, because he's just too one dimensional. He's good at getting in behind, getting into space, but when that space isn't there, he's pretty much a non-factor. So I thought, I mean, it was unfortunate that, again, they went down to 10 men because that kind of negated Theo's really potential impact, but he still had the two best chances in the game. So again, I'd like to see Theo, but I'd like to see Theo out wide where he can have a bigger impact in more space and play him alongside a proper striker, whether that be Giroud or Welbeck. On to Chamberlain. Now, I was very critical at halftime of his performance. I was frustrated, so that was part of it. But I just thought he looked, and I've said this about him before, he looked disinterested, completely disinterested. And we talk about we wanting to play with more pace. And we think, naturally, okay, you want to play with more pace, then you play with faster, pacier players. The problem with Chamberlain, he played so slow. He was so sluggish. He was so lethargic to pick up the ball. He was moving just – it almost looked like it was a training, kind of a, almost a charity friendly match. That's the type of pace he seemed to be playing at. And for someone who's 22 years old, who has still not – he's been at the club for, 4 or 5 years now? He's still yet to cement a first-team, consistent first-team spot in the starting lineup. To get that chance, which he did, and to put out that type of performance – forget – okay, I know his shot led to the goal, so I'm not going to discount that. But as an overall effort performance and a lack thereof, in my opinion, it's very worrying. It's very concerning that he almost, I feel like he thinks he's accomplished and he's proven himself in his mind, yet clearly he hasn't, because he didn't have a very good game. And that's a type of a situation where your number is called and you're brought into the starting 11. You should step up, but if nothing else, give the effort, give the energy. If it doesn't come off for you, that's fine. But what did you make of his performance? And am I being too harsh on that criticism of him?
I think I do agree with you. I think he did look more disinterested than he should have been. I mean, well, of course, he shouldn't be disinterested at all. So I do think he showed some disinterest, but I also think tactically he was off. And this has nothing to do with Wenger, because, I mean, Wenger put him on the right, but it seemed like Ox was doing almost a center mids role. He kept coming into the middle, and it's just so frustrating, because it's like Alexis is a right footer on the left side, so naturally he's going to come inside. But you were a right footer on the right side. Like, just stretch the field and play wide. And I do admit that he seemed to come in and just kind of want to do the easy pass here and there. He wasn't really, taking the ball and driving like we saw, with him against Chelsea, or with him pretty much in the whole preseason. He looked really hungry for it. So, that is surprising. And you're right. I think it also is surprising that, he hasn't cemented his place in the team. And yet when he's given the opportunity to start, he still doesn't look, or is not showing the form that he showed over preseason. And I don't know what the solution is, because I do think that Ramsey on the wing, when he was playing there, wing in quotations, I think that's all temporary. I think, you know, in the future, we have to look at these players, these quicker actual wingers playing on the wing. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people, or obviously even Wenger said it, that Chamberlain is going to be a center mid. But personally, I don't see him thriving there if he continues to make the simple mistakes that he does in the box. He doesn't have the distribution. The one thing he has is the drive forward with the ball, with pace and skill. And I think that that's perfect for the wing. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not really sure what to do.
Yeah, I just don't think he's proven with the opportunity. He has had his fair share of starts and sub appearances. He's had enough first-team football to prove that he deserves that starting spot consistently. And his efforts just have been, for me, all over the place and not consistent enough. And it's the simple things. Like I said, it's the okay. You're a fast player. You should infuse the squad with energy, with pace. And he played so lethargic, so slow that. And it's the simple things. He just seems so kind of blasé when he's on the ball or making passes. He lacks for me just that bit of professionalism on the pitch. Doing the simple things, doing the fundamental things correctly, game in, game out. I don't think he's earned a spot. And I honestly hope he goes back to the bench because I don't think he's earned it. And I think he needs to kind of be taught a lesson in what it's like to put in a consistent shift, match in, match out. There's others at the club that do that. Take a look at Alexis Sanchez, take a look at Ramsey, take a look at Coughlin in terms of just, if nothing else, if the passes, if your shooting boots aren't on, if nothing else, you've got to provide that effort and that energy at the minimum. And I think he needs to learn that's a trait he has not mastered yet. Until he does, I don't think he merits a spot in the starting 11. So, but only be interesting to see, you know, with the international break, will Ozil be back healthy? If he is, you know, he's probably going to come back in the 11. So we'll see what that starting lineup looks like in a few weeks' time. Just to wrap up the match itself, I mean, obviously we got the goal in the end. It was a bit of a jammy goal. You know what? Again, the way I looked at it is. Newcastle was never going to score that match. They never troubled us. We had obviously great chances before the goal came. So I think the result is fair and deserving. Any other just final comments on the match that any observations that stood out to you while you were at the ground about any, you know, individuals we didn't touch on?
Well, one thing that, you know, just coming off the analysis of the game itself, one funny thing that I forgot to mention at halftime. So I'm sure you know this, and everybody who's been to a football game knows this, that at halftime, there's always some kind of little event that the home team has. So I remember, I think the Newcastle's presenter walks on the field and he has three guys next to him and he says, okay, you know, we're going to do the crossbar challenge at halftime. And whoever hits the crossbar, win some kind of prize. And I remember he walked the three guys out to the 18-yard line where they were going to do their crossbar challenge. And he said, oh, can you please make sure not to scuff the field too much because, you know, we don't want to see Arsenal players falling over on the ground anymore. And I was just like, how much or how little class does your football club have? You've been moaning the whole game, been booing your fans off at halftime and off at full time. And then you have your TV presenter, one guy who's supposed to be professional. You know, he doesn't have anything to do with the game. And he's saying, oh, please don't scuff the field because we don't want to see Arsenal fans fall over or Arsenal players keep falling over. I'm just like, oh, that really pissed me off. And we were kind of screaming at him after that. But I don't know, I just wanted to show how, you know, when I go to the Emirates and, you know, our, you know, Nigel Mitchell walks out onto the field, he, you know, he was very happy to talk to the little West Ham fan who came out onto the field and, or the Liverpool fan that I saw. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like we have a much more classy team compared to.
Yeah. And on Newcastle, not that I'm concerned with this, or I think we'll have any magpie listeners to the pod, but they do seem like a club that, they kind of live in an alternate galaxy in terms of where they are as a club and where they think they are, where they think they should be. I mean, I go back to the whole Pardew thing. They wanted to sack Pardew, and clearly that was, you know, obviously the wrong decision, but it's and you talk about the on-field presenter who, yeah, would have a go at, you know, try to make like it's Arsenal players falling down. It just seems like that club and the fans moaning for every foul. They just seem a bit, I guess, deluded in terms of what's really going on in the football world. And you know, so, hey, that's I know they're in their own kind of universe up there. So, hey, fair play to them. But listen, 3 points away. Any doesn't matter what the performance is at the end of the day, that's always a very good result. We're 5 points off the top, which considering our form, considering our execution, our performances hasn't been great. I think that's a pretty decent position to be in. Problem is City look very, very good, and they've only improved their squad since the transfer window closed. So that's always, I think, going to be an uphill battle. So yeah, I mean, that's where we stand, and we got Stoke at home next. At some point, and we can probably just talk about the squad here in general. I'm in the camp where I think you look at our expected goals, you look at our chances created. I think at some point, you know, we're so below the mean of what our goals should be. I think at some point the goals will start coming in, because it's not, like I said, we're creating the chances. I honestly thought it was going to be Liverpool at home. So I'm going to remain optimistic. The Stoke match at home is probably going to be the match where the proverbial floodgates kind of open and it starts to click. And I think that's when we can expect to really put on a good run of form and at least start to finish our chances and start to score some bloody goals besides some own goals. So, what are your thoughts, you know, looking ahead after the international break and just as the squad as a whole, are you happy with our position, four matches in? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think nobody's extremely happy that we've lost and drawn. Great. Just getting a call.
That's a Newcastle presenter. He's taking umbrage with your criticism.
He's not liking this. I'm just going to mute myself for a second. You can talk about Stoke.
Hopefully AJ is an agent, somebody looking to bring a player on loan to Arsenal, and AJ is fostering that deal right now.
Yeah, Cavani. No, the transfer window closed yesterday. For fuck's sake.
Loan deal for Kallstrom, perhaps?
Oh, that's still available. Free agent.
Are there any direct flights from Siberia to London?
Berbatov, free agent. Just the striker we need. Bring him in.
So on that note, transfer deadline day, it came, it passed. It was, for the most part, uneventful. Definitely from an Arsenal standpoint. First of all, how did you spend your transfer deadline day? And what were your expectations? And what were your, I guess, kind of summarizing thoughts on the transfer window as a whole for Arsenal?
Well, normally I think I would have said, if we had signed somebody on transfer deadline day, I would have said I was disappointed that it ended at 6 p.m. UK time, because that's 10 a.m. here. So, which means instead of me watching it for, 6 hours straight, I only got, you know, to watch a couple of hours, because I just woke up at 8 a.m. Plus it was the day after I just got back. So I was quite tired, but you know, I did watch 2 hours of it. And because there's no transfer activity with Arsenal pretty much at all, they barely even went to the on the Sky Sports. They barely even went to the guy at the Arsenal Stadium. So, to be fair, yeah, I don't know how I feel about it. I'm not surprised that we didn't sign anybody because I didn't think going into it that we would really. I didn't have that much confidence in it, but I do think that there is a little bit of something to say in that stat that everybody's screaming about a little too much, overreacting a little too much. But there's a little bit of a little bit of truth in that stat that we're the only team in the top five European leagues to not have signed an outfield player. That is a little shocking because, I mean, yes, I do think that this is the best team we have had since we've moved to the Emirates. And I genuinely can say that, you know, I honestly do believe it. But so has Stoke's team. Stoke's team looks the best that they've ever had, you know, and every single other team has improved so much in the Premier League that it is a little shocking that we only decided to go for a goalkeeper.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it, and that stat, okay, we're the only team who didn't buy an outfield player. I think without context, yes, that's a bit shocking. But in the context of looking at our squad, I mean, I'm certainly not going to be in the majority when I say this, but I don't think we actually needed to add an outfield player just by looking at our squad. Yes, you would like to add an outfield player that is better or certainly adds quality to the squad. But when you look at our squad, like, I don't think we really need an outfield player. I think our biggest need, you look at analyze the transfer window as a whole. I think our biggest need to upgrade the goalkeeping position. We did that. We did that very well with Petr Cech. Now, the problem with doing that is when we did it. We did it so early in the window that every single day since then, all you're inundated with is paper talk, rumors, Twitter. You know, you're just – Arsenal fans are being poked with a stick every single day since the Cech transfer. You know, Cavani – Benzema, so-and-so, this, that, this player, this player, this player. You get – we get so in a frenzy because we're being poked, we're being poked, we're being poked. And so we're almost being this kind of artificial fervor of wanting a player since it's been so long since we signed Cech. So I'm not in the camp of freaking out and overreacting and saying the club – we demand an answer from the board. We demand an answer from Wenger. Listen, we were active in the market. Like, there's no doubt about it. And if you want an indication of why we didn't buy anybody, Manchester United, who, for argument's sake, pretty much has an unlimited transfer budget, like no player or value is out of their reach. They spent 56 million British sterling to buy an unproven, raw Anthony Martial. That's the best they could do.
It was 36, right?
No, 56 with all of the add-ons throughout the contract.
Oh, okay.
36 million up front at the end of his deal, they would have paid out 56 million to Monaco.
Okay.
Okay, even if you want to call it 36, that's more money than Alexis Sanchez, who was a multiple cup winner from Barcelona that we paid just last summer. Now, you can't tell me Manchester United, given their spending prowess, they were after Cavani, they were after Benzema, they were after Thomas Muller, right? They had to settle for Anthony Martial, who, if I'm going to make a prediction, he's probably not going to make that much of an impact in the next 2 years at their club. So that's what the market was like. And that's really, if you want a simplified answer of why Arsenal didn't buy anybody, especially in that position, because essentially that was the best that was available. And Anthony Martial, all due respect, good player, ton of potential, probably like him in the squad, certainly not for that money, but he's not better. He's not getting in the team ahead of Olivier Giroud, ahead of Danny Welbeck, or ahead of Theo Walcott. So a player like that doesn't improve the squad to help us compete for a title this season. So that's why I'm personally not that bothered or that freaking out. And as a second point, I think we have a pretty good squad. So, you know, if the squad steps up, performs like we know they're capable of, certain individuals, you know, I'm very confident in our ability to compete at the highest level this season. people don't want to admit that, or people don't think that, and that's fine. I certainly understand where those people are coming from. But I think we got a lot to offer, a lot of guys who can come back. I think Danny Welbeck has a lot to offer to the squad. I think he gets overlooked quite a bit and quite unfairly. I know we've talked about AJ, and we talked about this in our WhatsApp group, about the potential of a long-term injury to Francis Coughlin, which is a fair concern to have. And we talk about Arteta and Flamini, and could a buy another player could have been brought in. That's an upgrade. We've debated about that. We also got to think about, we have Jack Wilshere in the team who is coming back. I think all guesses out there, I think he's going to be probably available after the international break. He can certainly, now he's not a defensive midfielder like Coughlin, but he can certainly play that position again against certain teams. He could be in that role with a Santi, with a Ramsey. So I don't think we're as short or ill suited in some positions that people are making it out to be. So that's kind of my, you know, I spent the transfer day. I was a guest on the Bergkamp Wonderland pod for part two of the transfer deadline day pod, which was 6 a.m. my time. So I had a long day, and I got called a bunch of different names in the chat window. That was quite amusing to be able to finally kind of be a part of that. And because I was, again, I was on the, basically echoed the same opinions I just did now on the pod. And there was a lot of anger, vitriol in the chat window for the fact that we weren't buying anybody. So that was a fun thing to be a part of. But I just think the market didn't produce anyone that the boss deemed was going to be that level of quality to improve the team. And I tend to agree. Not because he didn't want to spend the money, not because he wasn't looking, or he left it to the last few days. No, those players just simply weren't available, and I think we have to live with that. We spent the money spent. If you look back over the past three transfer windows now, going back to the summer when Ozil came in, there's a lot of money that the club has spent on bringing players in, so they're not afraid anymore to spend the money, as people say. Spend the fucking money. They've spent the fucking money. Okay, like Mesut Ozil cost 42 million, Sanchez 36 million, Welbeck 16 million. We spent 10 million on a 33-year-old keeper from our direct rival. So that argument doesn't hold a lot of water, in my opinion. How do you feel? You know, is our squad short, in your opinion? Are you genuinely concerned that we're not, you know, equipped to mount the title challenge based on what we have, today, September 2nd?
I'm a little on the fence on this one, and you know, I often am on the fence, you know, which is not too good. You know, a lot of people like to pick one side or the other, but I mean, I understand both sides. I think, looking at our squad, you know, if you look at our first 11, whatever that would be, and our second 11, we probably have the second best squad in the league, you know, just behind Man City, who, to be fair, we really can't compete financially with. But, I mean, you talk about Wilshere coming back and these players coming back, and I do think that they will help us out, and it'll be good to have more of that depth again, a little more rotation. But I do think that, you know, yes, I think Wilshere could fit in for a Coughlin and do a decent job. We saw he's done very well, to be fair, for England when he's played in that deeper position. Plus, we know Santi has pretty much played almost deeper than Coughlin in certain games. You know, we've seen Coughlin deciding to go forward a little more. But I don't know. For me, I still think the direct replacement for Coughlin right now is missing, because I don't think Arteta is necessarily good enough to even be a sub. I know that sounds harsh, but I really think he's only good for closing out games. I wouldn't want him to start practically any game, maybe in a League Cup. I think he'll do all right. But I have to say, I just because his legs are gone, I mean, he just doesn't seem that confident on the ball. You know, everybody says his passing ability is great, and I do agree that his passing ability is great, but it just seems that when he gets the ball, he seems very, very nervous, and you know, you can see Santi do quick, tight turns and still manage to stay on his feet and keep the ball, but it seems like Arteta tries to Cruyff it and gets bullied and falls over and loses the ball, and then the other team's on the counter, and I just think that that's something that we haven't really addressed. You know, I know you were a huge fan of Kondogbia, and I know he went for a steep, steep price to go to Inter, which, you know, to be fair, he probably only went there for the money because, you know, it's not like Inter did that well last season in Serie A. Mm. But would you have spent that much money, even though that is a little overpriced? Would you have spent that money to bring him into the club? Because possibly... I wouldn't know, you know, in the future who I'd rather have, Coquelin or Kondogbia, but, you know, for how young that he is, I think that would have been somebody that in certain games we could play them alongside each other, you know, in the big games where, you know, we're away, you could play Kondogbia, Coquelin alongside each other just to shore up the midfield. But I do think that Neville did have a point when he was saying that we just look a little, our players in the midfield look a little slight, and I think if we could have brought in somebody with a little bit more of a presence, I do think that that could have improved us.
On Kondogbia, first of all, I mean, I am a fan of his. At the time, that was, I believe, right after, you know, they played us, and he did play very well. Well, he played very well the first leg at the Emirates. Watching him throughout the season, he's not a defensive midfielder. Actually, he's very much like a Schneiderlin isn't a defensive midfielder. He's more of a box-to-box.
When I hear that, though, and that is probably true, but, you know, Coquelin's more of a box-to-box than he is a defensive midfielder. We've trained him to be that. And I just think that, you know, Henry was a left winger. We trained him to be a striker. I mean, you can train people to play in a different position. I mean, I can't imagine Kondogbia I can't imagine he would be lost if all of a sudden we played him defensive midfielder and told him, hey, just don't go too far past the halfway line. I can't imagine he wouldn't understand.
That's a fair point. You know, with that, here's the thing. It's a gamble. It's a calculated gamble. Because I agree with you, I wouldn't want to see Mikel Arteta starting in Coughlin's position away to Chelsea. Now, I think Arteta can start at home against Sunderland and will be okay because
Sunderland's probably the only team I think I would be okay.
No, but like a Sunderland, like a Norwich, like you know, teams like that, we're going to have 75% of the ball, and you don't, you know, he's not going to be put into those situations where he's having to cover. I mean, ideally, right? So, but I agree with you on that. Here's the gamble: you bring in a player like a Kondogbia, like a Schneiderlin, like a Wanyama, just anyone in that kind of mold, right? Everyone's got their preferences. Doesn't really matter in this hypothetical. You bring that player in. Coughlin is going to be first choice because he's proven in our current side that he is at that caliber and he's got that experience. So you bring in a player that's, or you're trying to convince a player to come to a club where he knows he's not going to start the majority of games. So you bring that player in, and it's a gamble to assume that Coughlin's going to miss majority of games. So then you have that quality type of player to come in instead of an Arteta. So that's a gamble. Cause what if you bring that player in and Coughlin plays 48 matches? Now you have an unhappy player who is on high wages, and you just stumped 20, 25 million for player who's part bit. Right?
But I can't imagine I can't imagine we told Danny Welbeck. I know it was for a little less, 16 million, but I can't imagine we told Danny Welbeck, oh, you're going to start every game. I think he knew, you know, he was going to have to work his way. And to be fair, besides Cech, who knew he was going to come in and start, and, you know, besides Ozil, I think Wenger, I can't imagine he's telling them, hey, you're going to start my team for sure. I think he's going to say, I would like to start you, but you're going to have to, you know, work your ass off and work your way into the team. So I do agree that is a good point that, you know, if we did bring in a Schneiderlin for that much money or a Kondogbia, Are they really going to want to sit on the bench? And I do think that that's a valid point, but I just think that I don't think that they'll be on the bench that much. I think the reason we haven't seen much of Arteta is obviously a big part of it is because, you know, Coquelin is so important to our team. But I think it's also because Wenger doesn't really trust him too much, to the sense that, you know, in the Crystal Palace game, he brought on Oxlade-Chamberlain and moved Ramsey alongside Cazorla rather than bringing on Arteta first. So I think there is a little bit of doubt in Wenger's mind about playing Arteta too much, because, you know, he is 34. He is somewhat past it. So for me, if you did bring in a Kondogbia, and let's say he didn't start over Coquelin, I still would imagine that he would come on as an earlier sub. Also, like I said, play alongside Coquelin. Also, just give rest to Coquelin. I mean, I can't imagine. I think if we had two Coquelins, put it this way, if we have Coq 1 and Coq 2, I think Wenger wouldn't mind taking out Coq 1 for Coq 2 because he has faith in him. Whereas I think with Arteta, he doesn't really have complete faith in him. Enough faith in him to not buy a defensive midfielder, but not enough to play him that much. So, you know, if he could have it his way, he would play Coquelin 50, 60 games in the season. But we know that's just not going to happen. He's going to get fatigued. He's going to have bad form. He's going to maybe get injured. You know, he can't be that consistently playing. So I do think if we brought in somebody, I would have spent that extra money. And I know it's expensive. I know he might not want to stay on the bench, but I don't think he would be on the bench that long. I think him or Schneider, Kondogbia or Schneiderlin, I think they would get minutes. And I think Wanyama, that's completely different, because I think Wanyama would be okay, or I don't know if he'd be okay, but I think he would sit on the bench a lot more than, you know, the two we just previously mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I just think from a managerial standpoint, from a cohesion, from a keeping a squad unity close and tight, and obviously Wenger likes smaller squads. A lot of managers do, actually. Look at Chelsea. Look at who is Chelsea's backup to Nemanja Matic? It's John Obi Mikel, right? Who does City play if Yaya Toure goes down with a season-ending injury? Fernando. So you look at other clubs in that position. It's easier said than done to say yes, we'd like someone of Coquelin's quality to be there as a contingency or as maybe a counterpart. But it's a lot harder to sell that position to a player. Pay a player. I mean, Schneiderlin's on 150,000 at United. Kondogbia, who knows what he's getting at Inter. Not to mention, let's be honest, is there a reason only Inter went in for Kondogbia? Not Juventus, not PSG? I don't know. I mean, these are things we don't know. We're not scouts. We have our opinions. We have limited sample size to judge these players. If Coquelin blows his ACL out tomorrow, we're all going to sit here and say, ah, fucking Wenger should have bought Wanyama. And that's, you know, and those people will say, ah, I told you so. And that's fine. But that's kind of, again, it's the same argument you can make if Toure goes down with an Achilles, if Matic goes down, that's kind of the risk you have to play with the squad. And listen, for me, in a 7-game small sample size, playing 15, 10 minutes, you know, to close out a match, I'm okay with Mikel Arteta. I think next year we'll see that purchase, that, you know, another midfielder come in, because Flamini's and Arteta are both, their contracts will be expired. And so I think we'll see that. But I just think right now, all the factors considered, I just think Wenger looked at it and said, you know what, I think we'll be able to cope and do okay. And you know what, hey, I mean, shit, if Mesut Ozil gets a season-ending injury, we don't have another world-class number 10 sitting on the bench, do we? Not really. If Sanchez tears his ACL, we don't really have a player like him at that same level ready to come in, and we won't skip a beat. So that's kind of the risk you take with any position in any squad.
I agree to an extent.
That's why I'm not that upset at the fact we haven't brought in, because I just don't think it's that feasible in this circumstance.
Although I do think that those are valid points, I think if we lose a Mesut Ozil, we have enough creative players. Not necessarily, you know, number 10s. You know, Ramsey actually played technically in the number 10 rather than Cazorla in the last game. But I think we have enough creativity or creative midfielders that I think we could live without an Ozil playing. Obviously, do I want him to be injured? No, of course we'd rather have him in the team. But I also think if an Alexis got injured, I think our backup in a Wolcott or an Oxlade-Chamberlain, I think is a viable option. I think those are viable options. I think those are still good players. Whereas I think when I look at Coughlin's backup and I look at Arteta, you know, I think Arteta is a much worse backup than a Wolcott is to an Alexis.
Yes, but Chamberlain isn't going to – if Chamberlain is asked – if Alexis Sanchez is injured, and I'm knocking on wood like a motherfucker right now, if he tears his ACL, Chamberlain is not at the level where he's going to get you 24 goals and 13 assists this season. He just isn't. And there's probably – there's not many players in the world that can, because that's how good Alexis is. But I think that's the calculated gamble you take it's a fine line, and how do you measure it, and how do you know, going too far, not doing enough? That's, you know, we can all have different opinions on it. That's Arsene Wenger's opinion. He feels he can trust, obviously trusting Coughlin, and in a pinch, we're gonna have to trust in Arteta and possibly Flamini. Even though that's a curse word in an Arsenal fan base, and you know what, they've proven their value. They've proven their worth. These guys aren't worthless dipshits who can't kick a ball. Who can't? Let's not sell them all that short. No, they're not world class. Yes, they have their flaws. Yes, they're on the downside of the careers. But in a pinch, I don't think that's going to be the reason why we don't compete for silverware, I think is my kind of thesis on the topic. So, you know, we'll see. Again, Coughlin gets hurt next week, everyone's going to be losing their shit, and that's kind of the, you know, the bad or the good luck you have in any sport. If your best players stay healthy, guess what? You have the best chance of success, right? If LeBron James is out for the season, guess what? Cleveland Cavs, they ain't that fucking good, are they? So you kind of have to rely on your best players staying healthy. And
English people have no idea what we're talking about when we say
yes,
all that. But
LeBron James is a basketball player in America. He's very good. He's basically the Leo Messi of basketball. I'm taking the piss. Of course, everyone knows who LeBron James is. I think we could probably wrap up, transfer talk and that kind of the week that was in the world of Arsenal. Anything else you want to add or discuss before we head to our shout outs and sign off?
Well, we do have to go quickly over listeners' questions. I do have
a
few of those. Yeah, no, I will go over that.
Can you tell I've never hosted? Can you tell I've never hosted? I clearly don't give a damn about the listeners.
No,
I only want to hear myself speak. So.
You've done a perfect job, honestly. One thing actually that I want to say, because I listen to my own podcast, I'll admit it. So my listener question to you, to start off listeners' questions, is do you think Gabriel has done enough in the past two games to start over Mertesacker against Stoke and possibly just continue starting over Mertesacker? Because I thought he was absolutely fantastic in the past two games that he's played. And to me, his speed, his tackling, his aggression, he still wins a few aerial duels. He doesn't screw around the ball. You know, you don't see, you know, the Mertesacker 1 mile an hour Cruyff, much like Arteta, where you just are, you know, biting your nails the whole time, hoping that he won't fall over or lose the ball. But, you know, Gabriel, one thing that I noticed, you know, I do think that we need to keep possession in tight positions. But there was one time, I think against Newcastle, where he was, you know, running back. He had the ball at his feet, but he was running back towards our own goal. And instead of trying to trick his way out of it or play the perfect pass to one of our central midfielders or fullbacks, he just played it out of bounds. He just let our hold defense and midfield, come back, regroup, and, you know, we ended up winning the ball. And of course, it's against Newcastle, who, you know, maybe a little won't capitalize on that that quickly. But I don't know. For me, I think we saw, especially against Liverpool, you know, Cazorla didn't clear the ball. Chambers on many occasions didn't clear the ball. And I think sometimes it's good to just get it out. So anyway, yeah. Do you think Gabriel has done enough to warrant a starting position alongside Koscielny over Mertesacker? Who, by the way, I mean, we're running out of captains. We're kind of pushing them all in and out of the team.
Yeah, funny enough, I tweeted after the match, I go, has Mertesacker fallen to the captain's curse? Because we've seen it, Vermaelen, he got injured, and Koscielny and Mertesacker emerged. We saw with Arteta where he got hurt, and then Coughlin emerged, and he lost his place. Answer the question, yes, I think Gabriel has done enough. I've been very impressed with him. Like you said, the physical attributes, you know, his ability to cover ground and to make up space if players get in behind, I think obviously is an upgrade on Mertesacker. But I don't think that Mertesacker will be dropped. Again, you look at when Vermaelen got dropped for Koscielny or Mertesacker, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was Vermaelen, Koscielny. They weren't performing well. They were leaking goals. And so Mertesacker and Koscielny now, they have a track record of success. They have a track record, obviously, an understanding, a kind of a fire and ice type, you know, contrasting style. So, not that Gabriel hasn't performed enough to merit a starting spot. I just think Mertesacker, I think he'll bring him back in. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Gabriel get more starts as a rotational situation, whether it be obviously in the cups. You know, if we have a midweek match, I think he'll get more opportunities than he did the second half of last year, because he certainly earned that right, I think.
Yeah, hopefully it'll just be a tactical decision. You know, when we're playing Man City and we have to go up against Aguero, it'd be perfect to have Gabriel on the team rather than a Mertesacker. Although I know they're currently the best team in the Premier League, and you might say you want your most experienced player, I do think, you know, Wenger needs to make tactical decisions against certain teams. So against an Aguero, you would like to have a pace in your two center backs, so that if he does break away, we know that we have two very quick center backs who actually probably could catch him. You know, if he's focusing on the ball dribbling, you know, it is possible that both our center backs could catch up to him.
Yeah, I think it's another good problem that we have. I mean, going back to last year with injuries and everything, we had at some points no healthy able center back. So now we have with Mertesacker. Hopefully Mertesacker is not ill anymore. I mean, that was a very lengthy illness. So yeah, I mean, hopefully he's actually back after the break and able to not only live but also play football. So if that's the case, assuming it is, we have three very capable center halves. Chambers has got some learning to do, but that's a good situation to be in, as opposed to being completely left short and moving Nacho Monreal to center half. So it's a good problem to have, whether Gabriel retains the starting position or not.
Yep. And then, so that's a good answer. I'll move on to my next listener's question, and it's from Mark, the Aussie Gooner. Good old Mark. Always a pleasure him asking the questions. This is actually a long question. We were just private messaging each other about a week ago, and we were discussing the Arsenal. And, you know, he I think, you know, first of all, we should say that I think he jinxed Ozil into getting injured, because I'll just say the question. He said, are we any better as an attacking force since Ozil took over from Santi as the number 10? Both before and after Ozil signed, Santi has had more assists than him. Plus, the team's total goals have stayed at the low 70s in the EPL. I love him as a player, but do sometimes wonder if we're better off than when we had Santi as a number 10. So, and then anyway, then the next day we found out Ozil was injured. So, thank you, Mark, for that. But What are your opinions on that? Because it is somewhat of a valid point, and I just want to hear what you have to say about that.
First thing I'd say is don't look at assists, fella. Look at net assists. Don't look at assists. Look at net assists.
Like it.
Okay, that was an awful bantering of Arsenal Mo and net spin. Anyways, I'm going to go jump through a window now.
That's a good one.
No, I mean, all due respect, Mark. That's a fair point that you bring up the assist, but let's look at chances created and Mesut Ozil's assists. He's created enough chances to basically lap Sané's assist count about four times of what he got. The problem is people aren't finishing his chances that he's creating for them. So there's no scenario, there's no universe, there's no opponent where we are not a more efficient and threatening creative side without Mesut Ozil on the team. I mean, just look at Newcastle as an example. We needed his vision, his ingenuity to break down that 10 men behind the ball, and we didn't have any. I mean, Santi was in that position pretty much, and we had nobody who could do it. So yes, Santi's got some assists mainly from through balls in the back. And listen, that's a great threat to have. It's a great threat to have two players with fantastic vision and through ball ability like Mesut and Santi. You can really break down lines with it when you have two players of that caliber. But in no way are we better off moving Santi forward and having Mesut not in the side at all. Absolutely not.
No, I think I do agree with that. But it does not necessarily make me think that we should not play Ozil, because I think you're right. I think it, you know, all day long I would have Ozil as the number 10. But it does also make you think that, you know, against the Sunderlands, the Norwiches, we could rest him, because, I mean, he does seem to kind of pick up these – not he doesn't pick up injuries too often, actually, but, you know, he does look fatigued after a while. So that's always something that we can do. But going on to the last listener question from our good old friend Peter Canelli. He says, hi, guys. So, hello. How are you doing? Are the days
– Cheers, Peter.
Cheers. are the days of playing two strikers finished? Wolcott cannot be a lone striker, but I think he can play off Giroud. You know, we've heard this a lot from Arsenal fans, trying to switch back to a 4-4-2, but we've cemented this 4-2-3-1 system for, you know, over 5 years now. But what do you have to say to Peter Canelli's proposition?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I actually was talking about it with somebody today on Twitter briefly. When Danny Welbeck comes back, assuming he still has two legs that are able to walk on, let alone play football on, I think that's what we'll see. We'll see I think we will see some kind of a morphed, modified version of a 4-4-2. It's not. It's again, when you see the lineup on Sky Sports, it's not going to say 4-4-2, but the attacking positions that those players will take up, I think we'll see Welbeck, or whether it be a Theo, we've even seen Ramsey pop up in kind of a second striker position when we're in a team's attacking third. So I think it does have its value, and I think there's players that can absolutely benefit from being in those positions. And I'm really high on Danny Welbeck train right now. I think I watched a video of him earlier. I think the things he brings to the side just are unlike anybody else in terms of just his overall input, his overall his energy, his pace, his willingness to press. I mean, he just gives something that we don't have right now. And I think when he does come back, it's going to be a massive boost. And I'm not even worried about his goal scoring, is his stats. He's so much more of a player than that, and his impact is so much more. You have to look beyond the stats. But when he comes back, yes, I think we'll see those kind of a bastardized version of a 4-4-2 with players in those positions.
All right, side question then, really quick. You know, since you've been talking about Welbeck a lot, that guy Welbs. Do you think? I mean, obviously Stoke, he'll probably be on the bench for that. To be fair, hopefully he'll be fit enough, but. When he is fully fit, you know, he's made a couple sub appearances. I know that's quite a bit in the future, probably at least a month from now. But Do you see him starting? And if so, where would you personally start him? Would you start him on the wing where he still does come central and get in the box? Or would you like to see him lead the line?
I think where we'll see his appearances will be, playing from a wide position. I just think his versatility almost does him no favors because, of course, he'll say he'll want to play through the middle, but the guy is so versatile and he offers so much that you play him out wide and you get the dividends from that. So he's not a player who's going to sulk and not be happy. The guy just wants to play. When he does, he goes out and gives everything he's got. So again, I think certain matchups, against certain teams, yes, he can definitely lead the line. I don't think that's his biggest strength either. I think he's more effective playing from a wide forward position. I think he brings more to the side as a whole, as opposed to if he was kind of stuck playing centrally. So I think his majority of his chances are still going to come from a wide area. But I think again, with his ability, he'll find himself in goal scoring opportunities through the middle and through the side.
If we're saying that we're going to have a Giroud at striker and Alexis on one wing and Welbeck on the other wing, who would you want playing on each wing? Because, I mean, normally we do like seeing Alexis on the left cutting his side so that he can score on his right. But to be fair, if he did play on the right side, he also could get crosses to the striker and the left winger, which would be Danny Welbeck and Giroud. And those are, two guys over 6 feet tall who could potentially win a lot of headers.
True. And that's where I think, yes, for the occasional match, you can have Welbeck in there as who can be in a somewhat effective target man. It's all about versatility and having options. And I think that's if you look at our recruitment as a whole, for Alexis can play across the front three, Theo can play across the front three, Welbeck can do that as well, Ramsey surely has the characteristics. Ozil's been played in wide positions and excelled. So these are all good problems to have in terms of a selection headache. And I think it provides competition. It provides guys a kind of a wake up, especially Oxlade-Chamberlain. If you don't perform, we have guys who we're confident that could come in and do the job. So you better step your game up and earn your spot, otherwise it's not going to be there anymore.
All right, yeah. So I think we'll move on to predictions now. Predictions ahead of the Stoke game a little over a week from now. How do you think we're going to do, and who do you think the first goal scorer will be?
I'm going to said it earlier on the pod, I'm optimistic that we're going to, break the floodgates open at some point. I think this is a perfect opportunity. Charlie Adam and Afellay will both be suspended because of their red cards. They're not really the Stoke of 3-4 years ago where they really get stuck in and make it really hard for you. They're playing a more expansive kind of open passing football style, which of course benefits us.
Respectable football, actually.
It is. And credit to Mark Hughes. I think he's done a good service to the league to promote that style of football. So fair play to them. I think this will be the match where we finally take our chances, and I'm looking at a 3-0 comfortable victory. And I think Giroud starts and gets the first goal.
Shit. I thought I was going to be cool when I said Giroud's going to get the goal. But yeah, I do think... I do think with all the talk about getting a new striker, I can see Giroud stepping up and hopefully proving us wrong. So, I'm going to say just pretty much the same, but I'll say 2-0 and Giroud getting the first goal. Anyway, now we can move on to our shout-outs. So do you have your shout-out today, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm just going to shout-out the all the lads at Burkamp Wonderland podcast. Again, they had me on the transfer deadline day pod. It was a lot of fun, a great pleasure to be on for the first time, and uh, they're they're good friends of the pod and all those guys, Gimli, Chris, Big Danny. I was on with John Welsh and Tim from South Africa. So shout out to all those guys. Keep doing what you're doing. Good stuff.
Yeah, and you can follow them at the AFC Podcast. They're honestly feels like they're our brother podcast. We've had them on so much. We should probably get them on soon, you know, start of the new season. So yeah, definitely try to get them on. My shout out is going to go out to a man, and the reason I'm taking a while to say this is because I have to find his Twitter. But yeah, a man who honestly always does the shout outs to all of us, because you know he listens to Upper Camp Wonderland, he listens to our Arsenal My Blood, and that is to Tim JBHARG. That's his at, so at Tim JBHARG. He is always tweeting us. You know, he'll tweet me, the pod, and Ryan, and often Stevie as well, and just a lot of the people that he follows, and just hopes to spread our following base. So I think that's always really nice when people mention us in their timelines when they really, you know, don't necessarily have to. So I wanted to give a shout out to Tim because, you know, he always is doing that for us. Plus, I love his profile picture because it's a South Park character. Looks like I can't even tell what that is. It's a cop with a soccer ball and a beer. That sounds great. Honestly, love that. So anyway, yeah, at Tim JBHARG. And then Ryan, where can they find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Ryhennick, Ryhennick.
Perfect. And you can find me at AJ Gunners 14. So AJGUNNERS 14. And then you can also follow the pod at Arsenal Blood Pod. So it's not Arsenal in My Blood. Like I said, couldn't fit Arsenal in My Blood, unfortunately. So it's at Arsenal Blood Pod. But yeah, that pretty much wraps it up, Ryan. Thank you for coming on. And as always, up the Arse.